I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Florida is known for citrus, alligators, and theme parks, but the state is also home to a large and politically powerful sugar industry. The Everglades agricultural area turns out half the nation's domestic sugar cane. We'll talk with 90.7 reporter Amy Green about her trip to the Everglades agricultural area and her investigation into the politics of the sugar industry in collaboration with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Plus, local novelist Kristen Harmel has a new book out. I'll talk with her about her story, which involves the Holocaust, Alzheimer's, and baking pastries. That's ahead on Intersection. It may take only a little sugar to make candy and cookies tasty treats, but sugar is big business. This election cycle, sugar growers gave more to political campaigns than tobacco companies. Big Sugar spends big to preserve a complex government program that benefits the industry by boosting the domestic price of the crop. It costs consumers about $2 billion annually. And in South Florida, nearly 700,000 acres are dedicated to growing sugarcane. That's where 90.7's Amy Green traveled to and filed this report in collaboration with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting.
Just south of Lake Okeechobee is the Everglades agricultural area, where millions of perfectly aligned rows of sugarcane stretch to the horizon in all directions. The green stalks sway like waves in a grassy sea. The U.S. Sugar Program makes growing sugar here possible for farmers like Rick Ross. Wearing a plaid shirt, blue jeans, and gold chain around his neck, Ross says the sugar program gives him stability.
I can go to a banker and say, look, I'm producing this many acres of vegetables, this many acres of sugarcane. Here's my 10-year history of what I've done the last 10 years. Will you loan me $2 million to plant crops? And they go, yeah.
The sugar program guarantees farmers like Roth a minimum price by controlling supply, limiting imports through tariffs. Roth says farmers need that stability because farming is a risky business, dependent on weather and global markets.
Having a sugar program means that the banker knows with certainty that I'm not going to sell the price of sugar below this price. He knows I'm going to get at least 18 cents for my sugar. And he knows I'm going to sell all my sugar.
While that's good for farmers, several high-ranking congressional members say the sugar supports cost food consumers too much, and they want to end them. But Big Sugar is spending millions of dollars to preserve a program that inflates the cost of groceries like bread, fruit juice, and ketchup for all consumers. Lance DeHaven Smith is a professor of public administration at Florida State University. He says the program's costs are spread out among consumers, while the benefits are concentrated for sugar growers.
So the general public doesn't mobilize on the issue. It's not something that they see. Whereas for the industry, it's extremely important, and they're attentive to it and mobilize and try to influence policy.
The sugar program is part of the Farm Bill, a massive measure shaping U.S. policy on agriculture, rural development, environmental conservation, food aid, and more. It comes up for renewal every 5 years and is set to expire this year at the end of September. University of Central Florida economist Sean Snay says the sugar program's effects are complex. He points to losses for confectionery makers.
By raising the cost of sugar domestically, it has hurt the domestic confectionery industry. Has pushed a lot of candy makers over the border into Canada. You know, so there are jobs lost there.
But Snay says in Florida, there is an upside
because we have the industry in our state, and the industry benefits from these programs that our state, by proxy, will benefit from them as well.
Politicians also benefit from Big Sugar's political generosity. Florida Democratic Senator Bill Nelson is the Senate's second biggest recipient of money from sugar growers this election cycle. He received $42,000 in contributions. His reelection campaign against Republican Congressman Connie Mack is considered key in determining control of the Senate. Mack received $29,000. The state's other U.S. senator, Republican Marco Rubio, got $5,000 this election cycle. In his recent autobiography, Rubio, who was on the short list of vice presidential candidates, writes about the sugar support he received during his 2010 campaign.
This is the most significant single area for growing food in the United States.
At his South Florida farm, Ross says that bounty is possible because of the region's massive sugar-growing infrastructure. The Everglades agriculture area turns out half of the nation's domestic sugar cane harvest.
California as a state grows a lot more food, but they grow it over a 400-mile area, you know, from South California to Northern California. We're talking about farming in one area almost year-round, and nobody else does that.
Lawmakers have introduced multiple measures aimed at reforming or ending the sugar supports, but so far, all of the measures have failed. The Senate passed its version of the Farm Bill in June, protecting the sugar program. Both Nelson and Rubio voted to continue it, but now that the Farm Bill is in the Republican-controlled House, the program may face more opposition. Either way, expect Big Sugar's political spending to continue. I'm Amy Green, reporting for 90.7 News and FCIR in Orlando.
That's 90.7's Amy Green, and support for that story also came from United Arts of Central Florida. Amy joins me now to discuss growing sugar in South Florida. Great to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
So, Amy, you traveled down to this massive area of acres called the Everglades Agricultural Area to report on this story. Talk to me a little bit about just how much of an impact does growing sugar have on that region?
Sugar growing is the predominant industry in that region, and that sugar program makes that possible. There are good sides to that, and there are bad sides to that. You have an economy there built around growing sugar, but you also have people who say, you know, look, this economy there, it is depressed and it needs to diversify. And that sugar program has discouraged that because it has made sugar growing easy there and profitable there. You also have environmentalists who criticize the sugar program for encouraging growing in a region that is environmentally problematic for the Everglades and for water in that region.
One of the interesting things that I think you touched on is diversity down there. There's whole towns, for people who haven't been there, there's whole towns that are basically dedicated to the sugar growing industry. And I know you went to one of those towns, Clewiston, which is basically a U.S. sugar town.
Well, U.S. Sugar Corps is the nation's largest sugar cane grower. It's the nation's largest sugar cane producer. And certainly that town wouldn't exist without U.S. sugar.
Well, what are the most interesting things you came away with from the story?
You know, you hear environmentalists complain about sugar growing in that region, and certainly, you know, there are environmental problems connected with agriculture and growing sugar in that region. But when you are there and you're driving around, it really is beautiful. They use GPS to make the rows of sugarcane perfectly straight. And you just, I described it in the story as a sea of green sugarcane. It just stretches out all around you for miles and miles and miles. And I interviewed Rick Roth, a sugar farmer, when I was down there, and he talked to me about how peaceful he finds it when he's out there in his fields and the sky is blue and the sugar fields are green and the dark muck soil. It really is beautiful.
So surrounding sugar, of course, there's a lot of political support. There's food manufacturers, business and small government advocacy organizations, environmentalists that are mounting a campaign to try to end the sugar program. But you mentioned farmers like this fellow Rick Roth, who you interviewed. What would happen to him if that sugar subsidy went away?
Well, there's a lot of debate about that, and a lot of different people say a lot of different things. I think most people agree that ending the sugar program would mean a drop in the U.S. price of sugar, which would be good for food consumers. As I reported in the story, independent studies have found it costs consumers $2 billion annually, about. But for that Everglades agricultural area, which is so dependent on growing sugarcane, most people agree that any drop in price would be pretty devastating for that region. And already that region is experiencing some pretty serious economic problems. U.S. Census estimates unemployment and poverty rates in that region at 40%. So, you know, you have that factor to consider. A lot of people say that if sugar growing were to go away in that region, it would clear the way for development, which environmentalists would not be happy about. Other people say that getting rid of sugar in that region would clear the way for environmental restoration. Rick Roth, the sugar grower who I interviewed in Belglade, he was unconvinced that sugar growing in that region would end if you did away with the sugar program. He points to the massive sugar growing infrastructure in that region. You can't grow sugar just anywhere. It's not a crop like growing celery that you just pick and you take it to the grocery store. Sugar needs to be refined, and that region is home to a massive sugar refinery infrastructure. So he believes sugar would continue in that region for that reason. He also points to demand.
And it's really thanks to you. It's called more mouths to feed. As you have more people in the world, demand is exceeding supply. And that's what's driving the price up.
That was Rick Roth, a sugar farmer in Belglade.
So the politics are also a really big part of the U.S. sugar program. And you mentioned in your report that sugar is part of the Farm Bill, which is moving through Congress right now. What's the latest on that?
Well, the Farm Bill now is stalled in the House, and a lot of people think that it probably will remain that way until after the November elections. The Farm Bill expires September 30th, and so a lot of people think that probably what they'll do is approve a temporary stopgap measure that will keep things going, and then they'll come back and look at it again after the November election. The problem with that Farm Bill is that it's now in the Republican-controlled House, and Republicans, of course, are shying away from government programs.
Are there national congressional names that we would recognize, people who are trying to shut this down?
Well, Richard Lugar out of Indiana, he was on the Senate Agricultural Committee, and he had introduced a measure last year that would have ended the sugar program. Other senators and House members, too, had introduced measures looking at reforming or ending the sugar program. But this is all politics. The big sugar is a very politically powerful special interest group, as you heard in my report, and eventually all of those measures have failed. At this point, the sugar program is preserved as is.
Talk to me a little bit about the politics in the U.S. Senate. Florida's own U.S. senators, as you mentioned in your report, they are benefactors of U.S. sugar's political generosity.
That's right. And in fact, as I reported in my story, Bill Nelson, Democratic senator from Florida, he is the second biggest beneficiary of sugar growers this election cycle in the Senate. The biggest beneficiary is Debbie Stabenow, who is chairwoman of the Senate Agricultural Committee. Bill Nelson received between $40,000 or $50,000. Marco Rubio, Florida's freshman senator, he's a Republican. He received less money. He received $5,000, but he's not up for reelection this year. But during his campaign in 2010, he writes in his recently published autobiography about the support that the Fanjul family, a Cuban-American family, gave to him during his campaign in 2010. Marco Rubio, of course, also is a Cuban-American.
Now, your piece also ran in some newspapers around the state, and in that, you got into, it's not just in Congress, the influence of sugar also reached all the way into the White House, and not just under the current president.
That's right. The famous story, of course, is that Monica Lewinsky, the intern, and Bill Clinton were in the Oval Office discussing their relationship, and their discussion was interrupted by a phone call from one of the Fanjul brothers, and that was described in the Kenneth Starr report. The Fanjul family owns Florida Crystals, which is another large sugar growing company in Florida.
Well, let's talk about presidential politics this year. Of course, President Obama just making a swing through parts of Florida. How do you expect the politics of sugar to feature on this year's election debate?
As we discussed, the Farm Bill probably will remain stalled in Congress until after the presidential election. But underneath that, you have this undercurrent or this attitude of, you know, disfavor toward government programs. And this sugar program, of course, is a government program. Sugar growers, they emphasize that this is not a subsidy program because it's not contained in the federal budget. But either way, politicians, and especially conservative politicians, are not wanting to support government programs in this election season. So probably this conversation will continue. University of Central Florida economist Sean Snaith described it this way.
Yeah, I think this is just one program in a larger sort of agricultural policy in this country that we probably are going to be faced to revisit in light of the fiscal situation, in light of the discussion that's going on regarding entitlements and the U.S. government budget deficit and debt.
That was University of Central Florida economist Sean Snaith, and you heard him describe how the sugar program is just one program in broader agricultural policy. In a lot of ways, this is a microcosm of the way special interests work in our government today.
I've been speaking with 90.7's Amy Green. To read Amy's print story and see a photo slideshow of her visit to sugar growing areas in South Florida, you can visit online at WMFE.org. Amy, great to speak to you.
Thanks, Mark.
Up next, a local novelist writes about the Holocaust, Alzheimer's, and pastry baking. Kristen Harmel is an Orlando journalist and author of 7 women's fiction novels. Her latest is The Sweetness of Forgetting, which involves the Holocaust, Alzheimer's, and baking. Kristen Harmel, welcome to Intersections.
Thanks for having me.
Good to speak with you. So your novel is about a 36-year-old woman named Hope who travels to Paris to explore a family history that's been kept secret by her grandmother, Rose, who has Alzheimer's. So the setup is already interesting because it's about a secret history, which kind of is something that intrigues me. Why did you want to write it like that?
I liked the idea of the past that was buried in the Holocaust not being something that the grandmother had talked about. I think that is generally the case in a lot of cases of people who have survived that. A lot of people sort of lock those memories away and don't speak of them until a generation or two later. And that's certainly not in all cases, but, in some. And that sort of fascinated me. What would happen if you had locked sort of this secret past inside and now your memories are fading and you're realizing that when your memory goes, so too will all those secrets that you've held. So sort of that whole premise just interested me from the beginning.
And take us through for our listeners. Is it a story that is directly about the Holocaust, or is it a story that takes place with the Holocaust going around it?
Yeah, it's sort of the latter. It's basically a story of this family who lives in Massachusetts. And the women in the family have sort of had this tradition of coldness, of not really being able to express their love for each other or for other people sort of appropriately, if that makes sense. As the grandmother in the family is sort of fading away due to Alzheimer's, she reveals sort of snippets of this secret that lies in Paris. And the story that unfolds, which involves the Holocaust and which involves actually 3 separate religions also, sort of comes full circle and shows the main character why her family feels the way they do.
And is it coldness emotionally as a defense?
That's exactly it. Yes, it sounds like you're a psychologist. That's exactly it. I think that it's been sort of a coping mechanism, and as tends to be the case in a lot of families, sometimes the deficiencies in the parent are passed on to the child, and then they pass those same sorts of things on to their children. So it's sort of, yes, I believe it began as a defense just after the Holocaust and sort of has passed on through the generations.
The other thing that's interesting about the city that you choose to write about the Holocaust through, it's not in Germany or Poland. Instead, you're focused on Paris. Why did you choose that city?
Well, I actually lived in Paris myself about 10 years ago, just for a few months. But it was really the city that that sort of shaped me in my writing career. So it's always sort of a city that's been very close to my heart. But while I was living there, I discovered that Paris and France as a whole had much more of a Holocaust history than I realized. 76,000 Jewish people were actually deported during the Holocaust from France, 11,000 of whom were children. And of those, only 2,500 returned. So that was something that I really wanted to explore because it was something I didn't know a lot about and I felt a lot of Americans did not know a lot about.
And one of the interesting things you touched on is the cultural mix in Paris, which involves these people of different faiths.
Yep. And it's still that way today. Paris is a very much a melting pot city. And in terms of different faiths, I think there's a strong Muslim community, a strong Jewish community, and a strong Christian community. And all three of those communities really sort of come into play in this book in a very surprising way that was based on something that really happened during the Holocaust. During the Holocaust in Paris, the Muslims of the Grand Mosque of Paris, of sort of the Muslim center of the city, actually were responsible for saving the lives of probably around 1,000 Jewish people.
That's so interesting.
Yeah,
it's
is.
Certainly something that a lot of people don't hear about.
It's a story that's not told very often. No official records were ever kept of it, so it's just sort of an oral history that has only come to light, I think, within about the last 20 years or so. But I think it's fascinating just sort of in light of sort of the climate today in France and elsewhere. So I thought it was sort of an important story to tell that in history's darkest hour, or one of history's darkest hours, you know, people really came together despite religion and looked at each other as human beings.
How did you discover that story?
While I was in Paris researching this book, this was initially not supposed to center around religion at all. I just sort of intended it as a family story that delved into the Holocaust. And discovering that really put a completely different spin on the book.
You also did some research about the Holocaust here in Central Florida, right?
I did. There is a Holocaust memorial, which is sort of a museum in Maitland, actually. And I had not, prior to beginning to research this book, realized that it was there. But there are a lot of Holocaust survivors here in Central Florida, and there's a very rich resource in the Holocaust, gosh, I always get the name wrong, the Holocaust Memorial Resource and Education Center of Florida, which is based in Maitland.
Did you find that there was a difference in the interpretation of those historic events between the European perspective and American perspective?
That's a really good question. Yes and no. I think that, and this is just in my opinion, I feel like American Holocaust museums tend to focus more on establishing the basic facts. And then, of course, they go into it a little bit more. But I think that in Europe, the museums sort of begin with the understanding that everybody already knows the basics of what happened. So in Europe, I feel like the history is a little bit more immediate because it really took place there. And I think most of the people who live in Europe had grandparents who were touched in one way or another by the Holocaust and by World War II. So I also feel like in Europe, the museums maybe get a little bit more visually in-depth than we do here. To me, the photographs in the museums there were a little bit more disturbing.
In your book, The Sweetness of Forgetting, you also talk about cooking recipes, baking a large part of this story. And in it, your protagonist, Hope, runs a bakery on Cape Cod that has been passed through generations. And there's a lot of recipes actually in this book. How did that end up being a part of the story?
You know, I think it came partially from realizing how important baked goods were in Paris, or are in Paris, and from sampling many a pastry myself over my many visits to Paris. But it also sort of came from the idea that family history is everywhere. It's not just in the words we say to each other. It's in the way we're all raised. It's in the way we interact. And it's in the food that we make. So to me, this book is about a family that kind of stays silent about a lot of the very important things. And one of the ways they express themselves is through food. They own a bakery, and baked goods are sort of just very important to them. It turns out through the course of the novel that some of the family's secrets have sort of been baked into these pastries all along, which I thought was really interesting, in that your family history, you just sort of never know where it can be buried. And I think in a lot of families, food holds the stories that aren't always verbalized.
Is there an example from your family?
You know, quite uninterestingly, my family's not very full of secrets that I know, or perhaps they are and they're just more deeply hidden. But no, but I do think that my own grandmother has Alzheimer's, and I think one of the ways that I feel close to her these days as her memory is fading is to sort of bake the things that I remember her baking for me when I was a child. And sometimes I bake those things for her and send them to her, and I think it brings back a little bit of sort of her memory of the past. So in my family, I think food does hold special power, and I think it's like that in a lot of families.
Now, this is your seventh book.
It is.
And your earlier endeavors were definitely kind of in the chick lit genre.
They were, absolutely.
So this is a bit more of a serious tone, though. Why the shift?
You know, I wrote my first book when I was 24, came out when I was 26. And at that time, chick lit really made sense for me. It was something that was very hot in the market at the time. It was kind of just on the heels of Bridget Jones's Diary, The Devil Wears Prada, those type of books. And it was very reflective of where I was in my life in my mid-20s. Chick lit books are generally sort of about, you know, single women trying to figure out, you know, where they are in life. And I think they run the gamut from, you know, very, very light and fluffy to, you know, some of them do tackle more serious subjects. And I hope that my later books, my later chick lit books, did that. But this is the book I've really been wanting to write for a long time. And I struggled with getting people in the publishing industry to believe that this was the kind of book I should be writing. I mean, I did fairly well as a chick lit writer, and I think they said, you know, sort of, if it ain't broke, why fix it, sort of.
Give us more of that.
When I proposed this novel, which has kind of been the idea I've had for a long time, I was basically told, but that's not a Kristen Harmel novel. And I thought, well, that's odd. I'm Kristen Harmel. How could it not be a Kristen Harmel novel? But basically, it's sort of like I had established a particular brand. And I suppose it would be like a rock musician suddenly deciding they would release, you know, a country album. It's doable and it's been done, but people tend to think, well, why would you do that? What you're doing is actually working. But I just didn't see that as the future of my career. I'm very proud of those books I wrote. I read chick lit still, and I'm not saying I would not write another book like that in the future, but I really like writing books that dig a little bit deeper and that deal with deeper subjects. So it took me a couple years. I actually took a step back from writing, found a new literary agent who did believe I could do this, and this book already, even prior to coming out, has done better for me than all of the other six books combined. So I think that kind of says something about following your heart.
You wrote kind of right in first person for The Sweetness of Forgetting. Why that? Why not as a more removed narrator?
That's a really good question. And, you know, I had a really interesting experience with this book. I have pretty much always written in first person. I feel very comfortable getting in the heads of the characters and speaking just basically from their perspective, because I think it's really interesting as a writer to explore the idea that even when you're writing from your own perspective or from the character's own perspective, the character's not always clear about what they're feeling. And that's very interesting to me, the idea that there can be mystery even within someone's own mind. This book is actually told, though, in sort of an alternating viewpoint. Two-thirds of the book is written in the main character's first-person voice, and about a third of it is written from the grandmother's perspective. In the first draft, I actually had the grandmother also in first person. And that ended up being a huge challenge because the grandmother has Alzheimer's. So her first-person voice was very repetitive, you know, as it would be in a person who truly does have Alzheimer's. And that got difficult to handle within the story. So I had a talk with my agent about it, and she and I decided that I should take a stab at it in third person. And that was a it worked, and it was a very interesting lesson for me as a writer about why you shouldn't always just go with what feels like the right perspective to write in. Sometimes the story really dictates the perspective. So it's actually told kind of in two-thirds first person, one-third third person, if that makes sense.
Kristen Harmel is an Orlando journalist and author of seven women's fiction novels. Her latest, The Sweetness of Forgetting, involves the Holocaust, Alzheimer's, baking a family story. Kristen, so good to talk to you about it.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening. ¶¶